Welcome back to Post Traumatic Thriving. I am with my wonderful co-host, Ms. Tanya Brown. Hi, Tanya.
Hi.
And we have here. Yeah, it's great to have you. And our astounding guest, Rhonda Britton. Thanks for being here, Rhonda. Episode one, I'm going to just recap it in my own words. Correct me where I'm wrong. But you grew up in the Midwest. You had really, you didn't realize it, but kind of a horrific childhood. Your dad tried to kill you on one occasion, strangled you. That's just horrific. I can't wrap my head around that. Your mom wasn't really sticking up for you, but you had lots of friends. You had a boyfriend from kindergarten.
Kindergarten on. Had to get that first kiss in kindergarten. I had to manipulate him to get it, but I did get it.
Wow. You got it.
Whatever it
takes. Where I grew up, there's 365 inches of snow. So like one day I was like, we're playing, me and my little boyfriend. And I fainted Cinderella and or Snow White. And I was like, I am Snow White. You have a candy. He's like, get up. I go, and I made the poor boy kiss me. And then I did it again and I made him kiss me again.
Good for you.
Whatever it takes.
And then it turned into like Wedding Wednesday, right? In kindergarten.
Okay. Well, if you missed episode one with Rhonda, listen to it because it's in and of itself astounding in terms of what we're really talking about clinically is layered trauma. Right. And you already had a trauma, but Rhonda, I'm going to just go ahead and ask you, tell us about that day.
That trauma.
Yeah, the horrific day of my life, the worst day of my life, as I call it, right? Mm-hmm. Well, my parents were in the middle of getting a divorce for the second time. And my father was no longer living with us. He was living elsewhere. And it was Father's Day. So he was coming over to take us out for Sunday brunch. And growing up, you know, there's three girls, two parents, five people. We never went out to eat. We might once in a while we, you know, get a pizza, but that's really it. We never went to restaurants. So my father was taking us out to Sunday brunch, which was a very, very big deal. So my mother made me a brand new dress. It was white cotton with a black, white scarf with black polka dots all over it. I felt I was like Barbara Streisand for the younger people, like Beyonce, you know, so I felt like really pretty. And I was like, going to go to brunch with my dad and my mom and my sisters. And so I was in my mom's bedroom. She was fluffing her beehive hairdo and putting on her blue eyeshadow and her rose color lipstick. And, you know, my mom and I didn't have a lot of alone time, but this day on Father's Day, my two sisters were fighting it out in the bathroom. We had one bathroom. And so I snuck into my mom's room while she was getting ready and we just talked. And it was so exciting because I very rarely got this alone time with my mom. So I heard my dad come in the house, come on, come on, come on, because that's what dads do. So my mother looked at me and she's like, let's go. Me and my mother get up, we start walking towards the door, greet my dad, my sister's still in the bathroom fighting it out, and me and my mother and father start walking out to the car while my dad's going, come on! And my dad mentions it starts to rain, like a drizzly rain. And my father says, I got to go get my coat from the car. Makes sense, starting to rain. So as he opens up the trunk, I notice that he is not grabbing a coat, but he is grabbing a gun. And he starts screaming at my mother, you made me do this, you made me do this, and he fires. Now I start screaming, Dad, what are you doing, Dad? What are you doing? Stop, Dad, what are you doing? And he cocks the gun and he points it at me. And I absolutely 100% believed I was next. And he blinked, I blinked, he blinked, I blinked. I mean, I was literally waiting to die. Remember, he strangled me before. Got a gun in my face. I'm pretty sure I'm going to be next. And my mother, with one bullet in her already, looked up at that moment, saw that gun in my face and screamed, no, don't. My father, realizing my mother was still alive, took that gun intended for me, that bullet intended for me, and shot my mother a second time. And that second bullet went through my mother's abdomen and out her back, landing in the car horn. And the car horn just kept going for 20, 30 minutes. And then my father cocked the gun again, slid to his knees, put it against his head and fired. So within a matter of 2 minutes, I was the sole witness to my father murdering my mother and committing suicide. Mm-hmm. Now, I don't know how other people would respond, but how I responded is it was my fault because one, I didn't kick him in the shin. I didn't grab the gun. I didn't jump in front of my mother. I did nothing heroic, right? There's nothing heroic. I also felt like this was maybe punishment because my mother had just told me the week before, well, your dad has asked me for you to live with him. Hmm. Now, if you listen to the last episode, you're like, I don't think that's a good idea. And I was like, I don't think that's a good idea, Mom. So in my 14-year-old brain, I'm like, oh my God, like, right, this happened because I didn't live with my dad, right? Like, if I would have lived with my dad, right? So at that moment, I ran into my mother's bedroom and got on my hands and knees. I was planning, actually, just a few months before this, I had told my mother I was going to be a minister. And she was so excited because she always saw me as the minister's wife, the choir director, right? Because I sang. And so she, I remember her looking at me going, oh my God, you get to keep your name. I'm so proud. You know, she was so thrilled as a woman, you know, as a girl, thinking I could be a minister, like I could be in front of the church. She was so happy. So I got on my knees to God and I said, God, you got to keep my mother alive, right? You got to keep her alive. You got to keep her alive. And if she's alive, I will keep my promise and become a minister. But if she dies, all bets are off. Mm. Well, you know, she died. My mother died. My father died. And, you know, within minutes of this happening, so I'm in the bedroom praying and the phone rings. And one of my sisters answers the phone and it's my grandmother asking if my father had shot my mother. She heard the bullet because she only lived a few blocks away. And because all I heard was yes, yes. And then the phone hung up. And so my grandmother, when she heard the bullets, knew that it was my father shooting my mother. So from that moment, you know, I basically split in two that day, right? Like the external me and the internal me. The external me continued to be a straight A student, continued like I'm fine. I mean, I went ice skating the night they died because that's what I did every Sunday night. So I'm going to go ice skating. And I spent all night comforting my friends, right? Because they were like, ha, and I'm like, yes. And they're like, how can you forgive him? I go, I just do, you know? So I just literally just, you know, cut myself off. Like you, again, don't get to feel you, it's, this is the way it is. It's my fault. So the external me was straight A student. I kept going. Everything's fine. I'm fine. Everything's fine. I'm fine. And the internal me really basically, well, one, I gave up my desire to be a minister because now I didn't trust God. You know, no, God, you got to go on the other side of that line because you give too big tests. And if this is the kind of test you give, sorry, not interested. So I put a line between me and God. And I really decided, I think, that you don't get to be happy if you watch your mother die. You don't get to be happy ever again if you watch your mother die and you did nothing to stop it. And so externally, I was still that straight A student and, you know, became president of my class in 11th grade, you know, things like that. But internally, it was really just, you know, not liking myself too much, not, you know, what do you do when you have that level of guilt and shame and that level of blame, self-blame? So I didn't drink in high school. You know, I was class president. I was still fine. But the minute I hit college, which was I grew up like this happened in Upper Michigan and I went to the Minneapolis, University of Minnesota, Minneapolis. The minute I hit that big school, the minute I, you know, nobody knew my story. I started drinking and drinking, was not good to me. I blacked out all the time, but I didn't even care. Didn't care. I always say what makes me an alcoholic is when you black out, most people are like, oh, I should not do it again. And I was like, oh, I black out. I guess that's part of drinking. So I started drinking and, basically dating and drinking boys and alcohol. And, eventually, tried to kill myself three times, got three DUIs. And during this whole time of getting, you know, the suicide attempts and the three DUIs, and when you get the third DUI, by the way, you do spend a little time in jail. So I did the laundry in jail. And it was really the third suicide attempt when I realized I'm not very good at killing myself, not good at it. And I got to get some help. Now, mind you, I want to say before that third suicide attempt, you know, from the time they died when I was 14 to, you know, that time, I had nightmares every single night for almost 15 years. And every single night, my father was shooting me, killing me every single night. I would wake up in the morning, some mornings, and I remember it so vividly. It was like, I remember waking up some mornings and wondering how I was going to get out of bed because I had so many bullet holes in me. Like, I just literally felt like Swiss cheese. Oh, wow. So sleeping was not my friend. So I either slept with the light on because I was afraid my father was haunting me in my closet and my nightmares. So I either had to sleep with the light on, I either had to sleep with somebody, or I had to be drunk. And that's the only way I could sleep. Mm-hmm. And during that time, I still, you know, I think I'm an eternal optimist because I was doing everything I could to save myself. Like I started going to therapy. I went to workshops. I kept reading those self-help books. I mean, I did everything I could think of. You know, I did oils. I did energy work. Like I did everything. And it was all lovely and it helped release layers of that trauma, right? Every time I did something, I realized something, I, you know, discovered something, I faced something, right? It was all, I always say that doing those years of me having nightmares every single night and being an alcoholic and yet during the day, because I never drank during the day, except on Saturday and Sundays, of course, because it was brunch. But, you know, during the week, right, I would have a job. I would, you know, nobody would think I was an alcoholic at all. You know, just tried to do everything I could to save myself. So there was this dichotomy, right, of me on one hand reading every book and on the other hand, you know, drinking myself to death and then, you know, going to a workshop and then trying to kill myself. And that is really how I lived for, you know, many years. And it was that third suicide attempt, like I said, when I realized I'm not dying. I'm not dying. And everything I'm trying is nice. It's helpful. It's fun. It's enjoyable. It's like I'm learning. But it didn't take away the fundamental feeling that there was something wrong with me. I still felt like there had to be something very wrong with me. Like I was damaged. I was, you know, again, I could name a whole bunch of things, but there was something wrong with me. And I remember at that third suicide attempt, when they put me in a psychiatric ward to evaluate me because three times they check you out. Mm-hmm. And so I was evaluated. I was in a lockdown facility for, I think, 3 days with a little straitjacket there, you know, next to me. Mm-hmm. And I remember my older sister, Cindy, coming to see me. Mm-hmm. And because you have to remember, my two sisters now are going on with their lives, right? And I'm doing all these things, you know. And I remember my sister coming to visit me in the psychiatric ward. And I don't know if you've ever seen somebody the minute they lose hope. Because my sisters were, you know, just they, I'm not saying their life was great or by any means of the shape, you know, any means, but you know, they were living normal lives. And I think my sister Cindy kept thinking, I'm gonna be fine, you know, I'm gonna be fine, I'm gonna be fine. And when she came to the psychiatric ward, I remember her looking at me and realizing like in that moment that she had no hope for me.
And that's lonely.
It was
very lonely.
It was penetrating to your soul, my soul. Yeah. And so I went home to my little studio apartment. I was living by myself. And I remember getting home and just like literally sliding down the wall and saying to myself, I have to start over. I have to start over, to completely start over. And so that was the first moment that I said to myself, I have to change my life and I'm going to have to do it. And so I said to myself, what do kindergartners do? Because I literally was like, I have to start over. What do kindergartners do? Well, they get gold stars and a calendar. And so I literally went to the store. I'm not joking. Went to the store, got gold stars and got a calendar.
Good.
And I said to myself, I'm going to keep track of anything that I do that's good. Because I needed proof that I had a right to be alive, or that I had a right to be saved, that I had a right to exist. So, I mean, I still have that calendar, by the way, and oh, wow. it's in my office. Yeah. And when I read that calendar, it's just like, one of them is like, got angry, didn't break anything. You know, like that's the level of like where I was. Like I didn't get drunk. I drank, but I didn't get drunk, you know? So just anything. And at the end of 30 days, I had a calendar filled with stars.
Oh.
And that gave me hope. That was my hope.
Yeah.
And that's what people need, Rhonda. People need hope.
Well, they certainly do. But I want to stick with the dive stage, because it sounds like that's kind of the turning point to the survive stage, which is the next episode. But in the trauma itself, I noticed something as you're sharing your story that you didn't express shock. Maybe I misinterpreted, but it's as if you stood as a sole eyewitness. You were 14, right?
Yes.
14-year-old girl. You yeah. see your dad literally shoot and kill your mom and then kill himself. Was there a shock saw?
Yeah, I definitely think I'm in shock. I definitely think I was frozen in place, you know. I've done a lot of trauma work, and, you know, it's interesting, through the trauma work I've done, and a relationship later on that I had, and this was only just like 10 years ago, I was dating a man who had guns, collected guns. And of course I was like, you know, and so I'll never forget this. One of the most loving things anybody's ever done to me, and of course, one of the most courageous, is it was Valentine's Day. And he said, we're going to take the guns out. And we sat on his bed, and I'll never forget this. One of the greatest gifts this man ever gave me. And he put his arms around me, and I was sitting, you know, right in between here, and he took out every gun and he had me hold it and touch it. And I literally was, you know, obviously just crying and screaming and, you know, all these feelings moving through me. Right. And in that moment, I remember just at one point, just hysterically crying and like nuzzling in his, you know, his shoulder. And he goes, he said something, and I can't remember the exact words, but it was like, I'm here, you know? Mm-hmm. And that made me, and he said, like, you didn't leave, you were there, you stayed, and I'm here, you know? Yeah. And that moment, I had a spontaneous memory, because that's what's happened over the years. I've had these spontaneous memories of that day. And the spontaneous memory I had is, for many, many years, I thought I didn't do anything that day, right? I was frozen, right? He put the gun in my face. But that memory that came back, and this is, again, just 10 years ago, what I realized in that memory is I was actually walking, taking a step towards my father, which is one of the reasons he took the gun and pointed it at me. And I can't tell you, just knowing that I was taking a step towards them, mm-hmm. the level of next layer of shame left, you know, level of like the opinion I had of myself shifted. And that's the beauty of doing trauma work. The beauty of healing is that even the event itself, you find new pieces of it, and you find, you know, you make yourself whole, which, again, I know we're going to get to, but it's just like that day. Yes, I was shocked. I heard a voice the minute it happened. You know, like after the bullets faded and I'm sitting on the porch, you know, breathing hard, before I ran in the house, I heard a voice, God's voice, say to me, I'll never give you anything that you can't, you know, that I'll never give you anything hard that you can't handle, kind of thing.
Wow.
And I remember that's why, one of the reasons I ran into the bedroom and prayed to God, and why I cut him out, because I was like, if these are the kind of tests you give, then forget it. Right. So that day fundamentally changed my relationship with God. It fundamentally changed my who I was, because now I was a girl from that family. You know, now I'm from that family. So friends weren't allowed to play with me. People weren't, you know, I was a little ostracized. We were just a little ostracized, right? Because nothing like that had ever happened in our town. Mm-hmm. So it became, you know, like his blood runs through my veins. And I have to tell you, during those years of me drinking and having nightmares every night I was always scared that I could kill somebody. I was always scared that I'd be killed. I was afraid of my feelings. I was afraid of my anger. I was afraid of my rage because I couldn't let them out because I really felt that I would destroy the world if I actually allowed myself to feel the level of pain, anguish, heartache that I felt, the level of abandonment, et cetera, et cetera. If I actually allowed myself to feel that, I would destroy the world. Now, logically, of course, I knew I wouldn't, but during those years, one of the ways I regulated myself is with alcohol, but also alcohol gave me permission to be angry because I wasn't a fun drunk. I was a pissed off drunk, you know, but I was drunk. I didn't know I was doing that. I blacked out. I didn't know. So I could disassociate from all those feelings. And that's how I managed. I managed my feelings by dating, keeping myself occupied, you know, focusing on a man and trying to, you know, always like not pay attention to my father, but get a man to love me, get a man to love me, get a man to love me, and alcohol. And these were my friends. Because God sure wasn't at this time.
I got it. So you know the five stages of grief, I'm sure, better than I do. But we're talking about shock. We're talking about, I couldn't help but notice you had denial where you were denying things. You must have felt an inner rage. It sounds like you weren't acting out of anger towards others, or maybe you were.
I didn't get mad, I don't think, for a while. I don't think I got mad until I hit college.
Okay.
I basically just stuffed that sucker in. And it was really only when nobody knew my story. Because, you know, now I'm still in the hometown where it happened. So everybody knows my story. Can't run from it. But now I'm in a town where nobody knows me. Mm-hmm. I thought this was the greatest thing ever. Yeah. I could recreate myself. Nobody has to know my past. And so I always lied about it. I didn't lie because I'm not a liar. But people would be like, oh, your parents. I go, oh, they're passed. And then they go, both of them? And I go, yes. And they'd always go, an accident? I go, yeah, an accident. In my head, I'd go, yeah, my father accidentally bought a shotgun and then bought the bullets and then filled it in the rifle and then accidentally shot my mother, accidentally shot, right? Like, I couldn't lie, but I just let people believe whatever they needed to believe because I wasn't willing to say it. I wasn't willing to tell it.
Yeah. And you're bargaining. I remember you said you were bargaining with God. Hey, if you'll do this, I'll become a minister. Yeah. And then the depression, which is classic self-medication with alcohol. I mean, you went through, you were a kind of a textbook case of every single one of these stages.
And not only that, sorry, go ahead.
Every single one. Okay, so Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was right, the five stages of grief. Mm-hmm. When I work with my clients, it's like, you know, stage one, you may experience stage one, but the next day you may experience stage five. When you're experiencing trauma and grief, it doesn't go, it's not linear. It's a roller coaster. You could be at stage one day. You could be at stage five the next day, stage three the following day. It's very, very complicated.
Yeah. And I also thought I forgave my father that day because remember, I was going to be a minister. So I literally told everybody I forgave him. And I really believed I did. You know, and it wasn't until, you know, many years later where I really truly did forgive him. But, you know, so I walked around basically like, no, I'm good. I'm good. You know, and not only is this a classic case of, you know, the five stages, it almost when I started understanding what domestic violence was and really starting to evaluate what happened before my parents died, my father was stalking my mother. Of course, I didn't know this because, you know, but I went and interviewed family and friends like, you know, years later, and they told me how my father was stalking her, how the night before he killed her, he came to the house and put a gun in the window, pointing it at her while she was on the phone. So my mother was being stalked and harassed, et cetera. So one of the things that was devastating for me on some level is recognizing that this was a classic case of domestic violence. And not only that, as I'm sure both of you know, is that strangulation is the number one sign that they're going to kill you. Yeah. So my father strangled me, but then at another time, my father did try to, you know, grab my mother and took all the knives out and, you know, strangling her. And I'm there and I'm, you know, I get Linda to run outside to get help and police come and the police go, well, get him out of here, ma'am. But you remember back then they didn't get involved. So my mother's like, no, he's fine. And I'm like, what are you talking about? He took every knife out of the thing. He's going to kill you.
That was back in the day.
But that was back in the day.
We didn't talk about this.
So looking back on it, when I finally started, you know, when domestic violence actually came to the forefront, we started actually talking about it, I really realized my parents were a classic case. Mm-hmm. And if it was known back then, the ending might have been different.
Yeah.
For sure.
For sure.
For sure. Wow.
Well, this episode is titled The Dive Stage.
I did my job diving.
You did.
Walking around, drinking, suicide attempts, DUIs.
But you know what, Rhonda? Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people, it's okay to be mad at God. You know, it's okay to
absolutely.
You know, I don't want to say I hated God after Nicole's murder, but I didn't, most certainly didn't like him, right? I'm like, how is it that you can make things like this happen? Mm-hmm. And, you know, after hours of talking with my pastor after, you know, mm-hmm. Nicole was killed, like you get to that internal peace where it's like, it's okay. God has he has his plan. You know, but
it's not there yet. I'm not there yet.
It may not happen right away.
Yeah. No, it's not on your timing. It's divine timing, right?
It's in his time.
Well, and it's really the reason why I'm so big on timelines and keeping it is that it's essential that we don't gloss over parts of the dive, survive, thrive process.
Right.
Because in order to heal, you really have to, you know,
Go through it.
You got to process each stage. And, you know, Rhonda, I just got to say thanks because that's ugly stuff. I don't think it can be a more ugly story than what you witnessed. I'm anxious to find out about your survive stage. I want to learn more about the stars, the gold stars, and your survival mode. And then what I'm really also looking for is the thrive stage. But I would tell people, don't skip ahead to the good fun stuff in the last part of the episodes, because, you know, kind of going through each stage is what's so important. And you're right, Tanya, it's not a linear thing. The term I use probably 1,000 times in my book is rinse and repeat. Mm-hmm. You're always going back. You're always reprocessing. You know, you have trauma. I had open heart surgery when I was 11. And there are days, you know, I'm in my 60s where I still get mad about it. You know, that's the anger stage. So, you know, that's completely normal. We're going to process through this stuff. So
you also, Randy, you're saying like a very operative word, process.
Yeah.
You know, my parents were always like, why do you always share your story with everyone? Blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, okay, 10 years after Nicole's murder, I was like, oh my God, I never processed the pain. I never processed the grief. I never processed all the losses, you know, in my life. So Rhonda, that's what you're bringing to the table, where you processed, you know, we can talk all day long, but until you really get to like the root, the core of the pain, it will never go away.
Yeah.
So I think really like, you know, talking about processing it's huge. And that's why you are, you know, you're here today, because you've done that.
Yeah. Yeah, Tanya, you said Rhonda was amazing. I'm getting it. So
you're very sweet. Thank you.
Well, we've episode one, you know, go back. That's the life before the trauma, which was trauma, and then layered with this episode, you know, witnessing the murder of your own mom by your own dad. I don't know how that gets any worse. But we're gonna process through dive, survive, and thrive. Tanya?
The choice is yours.
Yeah. So we'll see you next time.
Thanks for supporting our podcast. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe, and follow us on your favorite social media. For books, merchandise, or to donate, visit coreiq.com. Post-traumatic thriving is produced by Core IQ, a nonprofit with a mission to teach the life skills we all need but are not taught in school. Core IQ and the Post Traumatic Thriving Podcast are for informational purposes only and do not provide medical or mental health advice. Always consult with your licensed medical and mental health care providers.